Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Dan Lynch, episode 171 for June 22nd, 2011, Software Freedom Conservancy. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Watch thousands of TV episodes and movies on your PC, Mac, iPad, iPhone, or TV instantly. All stream directly to you, saving you time, money, and hassle. For your free 30-day trial, go to netflix.com/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, back in the big chair. Well, whatever size chair this happens to be. I'm leading the show today again. I appreciate the opportunity to do this each and every week, or at least as often as I can get to do that. And, of course, it's such a big job that I can't do it all by myself, so I always have a co-host. And here's my co-host this week. Welcome back to the show, Dan Lynch.
Hey, great to be here again.
Very good, very good. And thank you for again agreeing to be a co-host on the show. I know you could be anywhere else that you wanted to be, and here you are. And that doesn't even make any sense, but we're just going to keep going right on. I do want to actually say that we have a really great guest for today's show. I have known him for many, many years, originally through the Perl community, as a programmer, but he's now moved on. Bradley Kuhn is our guest, and he's currently the director of the Software Freedom Conservancy. I also know about the Software Freedom Conservancy because it is the umbrella organization, a kind of an overseeing organization that allows software projects, small to medium-sized software projects, to not have to go through all their own paperwork to set up bank accounts and to set up nonprofit status if they want contributions and to take care of some of like the legal paperwork and stuff. That's a lot of work for a small organization if you're just a small group of developers. And so what Software Freedom Conservancy does is act as an umbrella to take care of all that. And it's going to be really great talking to Bradley Kuhn. I know I also want to get into some issues about licensing and how licenses work and maybe what his history is and stuff. So we'll have a lot of things to chat about. So I'm really looking forward to that. Before we bring the guest on, though, a couple things I want to do. First off, last week's episode was about Strawberry Perl. And as we were interviewing the guest, I sort of made the point that with ActiveState's Perl, you were basically locked into their PPM. Well, I've since been informed by multiple pieces of email that, no, ActiveState Perl, you can, in fact, if you install an extra C compiler and all the framework for it, you can build normal CPAN modules now. That wasn't true many years ago, but it's true now. But the point about Strawberry Perl is that you could just download it. It's all one big download. You already have all those tools. So that's really the difference between the two of those. So I just wanted to correct that. And also, before I get started, we have a sponsor this week. We have my favorite sponsor this week. We have Netflix as a sponsor as he's quickly trying to bring up preview to bring up the ad copy. Here we go. So this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Netflix. Netflix streams thousands of TV episodes and movies directly to you instantly, which means that you save time, money, and hassle. There's several easy ways to instantly access streaming movies and TV shows with Netflix. You can watch Netflix movies and TV shows on your Mac, PC, or iPad. You can also watch on your iPhone. I do that sometimes when I'm traveling on mass transit. It not while I'm driving. Do not watch TV while you're driving. Okay, and some Android phones as well. If you have a gaming console, an Xbox 360, a PS3, a Nintendo Wii, you can watch Netflix right on your TV. I have a PS3 and it works really well. If you're not a gamer, you can watch Netflix on your TV with an Apple TV or a Roku. I have a Roku and it works really great on that as well. They're inexpensive, easy to use. With Netflix, you can watch movies and TV shows instantly using any of those devices. And you can also begin watching a movie or TV show on one device, then finish on a different one. So whichever way you choose to access Netflix, you can watch as many movies, TV shows, anytime you want, and you can cancel anytime. So we want you to try Netflix today for a 30-day free trial. Go to netflix.com/twit. That lets them know that we sent you there. Be sure to use this URL when you sign up for your free trial, netflix.com/twit. And we thank Netflix for their support of Twit and Floss Weekly. And we hope you enjoy watching instantly with Netflix. So let's go ahead and bring on our guest, Bradley Kuhn. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Randall.
And where are we speaking to you from?
I am in Brooklyn in New York City in New York.
Great, great. And it's great to have you on the show after all these years. I know we've been trying to get you on for a long time, and I'm glad that Dan did some of the legwork behind the scenes to make that happen. So I gave just a brief overview of what I know about the Software Freedom Conservancy at the top of the show. So why don't you start with sort of just an overview and introduction about what it is and what you do there?
So my favorite thing to say about the Software Freedom Conservancy is that we do the boring and annoying work so that open source and free software developers don't have to. And by that, I mean we handle the things other than software development and documentation on behalf of projects so they can focus on that. Most developers are best at doing that, so they should spend their time doing it. But they often want the infrastructure of an organization behind their work so that they can do things, the classic example being reimburse developers when they travel to conferences and make sure that if they get donations, those donations can be spent to help the project. Those are the kinds of things we do. And the way that we do it is through a nonprofit concept called fiscal sponsorship. Now, mm-hmm. that's a weird word usually for people in the software world because you hear the word fiscal sponsorship and you think, oh, I joined the Conservancy and they give me money. Well, not quite, but close. What happens is we provide the infrastructure so that anybody who wants to donate to your project financially or any other way can do so through the Conservancy. And then the Conservancy handles all the nonprofit's issues and nonprofit paperwork so that you can act as a nonprofit organization while doing your free software project.
I know from having set up a number of nonprofit organizations that it's a lot of paperwork. It takes a lot of work and a lot of documentation. There's a lot of filing that has to be done every year to make sure that happens. I'm on the board of both Linux Fund and I was on a couple of other nonprofits before that. But it's just a lot of work. So what you're doing essentially is providing, I don't know, would it be fair to call it an umbrella where people can sort of stand and stay out of the rain and still collect the money as it comes in?
Correct. Yeah, umbrella is another term. In fact, it's frequently used as sort of a synonym to fiscal sponsorship. So we're an organization that's actually composed of all these projects. So we have just under 30 member projects now, and they become and many of them actually have been guests on Floss Weekly in the past. They come and join as part of the Conservancy. And they are basically what makes us up. We're made up by all these projects, and then we service their needs. And we have people can look on our website and see the list of services we provide. But basically, anything that a nonprofit might do for a free software or open source project, we do that for our projects.
Now, what's the significance of actually being a nonprofit in terms of how the money flows?
So there's a couple of advantages, and there's various different categories of nonprofits in the United States. And I'm going to mm-hmm. focus on the United States because that's what I know best because I'm a U.S. citizen and I run a U.S. nonprofit. And I'm going to apologize before I start. This is going to get a little bit IRS geeky for folks, so I hope they won't turn off, but it won't go for very long.
That's okay. You're the expert. That's why we're asking you.
Yeah. There are a number of different types of nonprofits that you can create in the U.S., and you're incorporated in whatever state or commonwealth you're in usually, so obviously. Since we're in New York, we're incorporated in New York. So we're a nonprofit in the state of New York. And then you apply for your federal status. And there are a couple of different types of federal statuses that you can get. There's, for example, one that we're not, which is the 501c6, and that's a trade association. If people know the Linux Foundation is an example of a trade association where a bunch of businesses get together and say, we have a common business interest. The Conservancy, by contrast, is a 501c3 organization. And that's the same status that you get if you're an educational organization, like universities are 501c3s and so forth. And it's sort of the best status you can get at the federal level. Two things are true when you have 501c3 status. First of all, you pay absolutely no federal taxes whatsoever as an organization. Second of all, people who donate to you in the U.S., are usually eligible to deduct those donations on their Schedule A when they file a 1040 each year. So by being a 501c3, we allow people to, our free software member projects, to accept donations that are tax deductible in the U.S. for their donors, which is a big benefit. It's very hard to get donations if your donations are tax deductible because a lot of people choose their giving based on, well, at the end of the year, I look at my taxes and say, well, if I give $1,000 away this year, my taxes will be this much less, so I'll give that much to various nonprofits. But they have to, in the U.S., be 501c3s. So that's why we have that specific status, one of the many reasons why we have that specific status for Conservancy.
Now, so taking donations and distributing them, do you have restrictions then about the way you can distribute the money through to the organization, or does the organization sort of figure out what to do with it?
There are some restrictions, but they're relatively benign, and they sort of are the obvious restrictions you would expect. First of all, we have to give the money away fitting with the IRS rules for 501c3 status. And that's pretty broad, as it turns out, because that's decided by what you filed. Sorry about the IRS geekiness. You can sort of ignore the numbers and just keep listening. You file this thing called a Form 1023, and that's your application that says, this is what my organization is going to be doing for the world to make the world a better place. Because a 501c3 organization, its job is to service the public good and make the world a better place. That's why the government allows it to get away with paying no taxes and receiving tax-deductible donations, because it's advancing the public good. So Conservancy's mission, I'm paraphrasing it, but it's this general sense of to advance open source and free software available for the public and to the public's general good. So anything you're doing in your project that fits that mission, which pretty much it's hard to do anything in an open source and free software project that's not doing that, we can help fund and help the projects raise money for.
So to make this a little more concrete, suppose somebody wanted to donate the $100 a month that it takes to run the squeak.org servers. They could come, because Squeak is a project underneath the SFC, they could come to and donate to the SFC, get their tax deduction for it as appropriate, and then we could spend it on the Squeak board. We could spend it on the $100 a month that it takes to run our server.
Absolutely, and somebody should tell me if you guys have some money there. So you should tell me if somebody's paying out of pocket for that $100 a month. We could certainly be using the Squeak funds now for that. I don't know if that was a hypothetical example or not.
It's actually real. We're about to switch servers, so yes, we are going to have an actual expense. So this is good to know. Hey, look, here I am chatting with the guy who's helping me run the Squeaks. That's great.
And just to clarify for people, we should note that, and this will actually be an interesting transition to talk about like how the details work in Conservancy. So each member project, we form an agreement, a formal agreement with that project to make it part of our organization. And I'll talk in a minute about why it's so important to do it that way. But as part of that agreement, the leadership and people who are in charge of that particular project are named, and the process by which they are appointed, elected, whatever, is also named in that agreement. And the reason Randall and I are sort of off on the side road talking about Squeak is because Randall's actually a member of that group of people who are the leadership for Squeak, which is in turn a member project of Conservancy.
Exactly. So we have this relationship then, the Squeak leaders, of which I'm one of the seven, have this relationship then with you guys at the SFC to be able to gather funds. What else does the SFC do besides manage this money flow?
Well, one of the main things we were founded for initially. We've expanded our service plan as we've grown. We've expanded what we're able to do for projects. But the main initial thing that we formed for, and this relates to what I was saying about why we make this formal agreement, was to extend, and this is where the umbrella part really comes in, liability protection to developers of open source and free software. So when you're sitting there hacking on your code and making it better, there's all sorts of things that can go wrong. They're not a huge risk, but the risk exists. For example, you could implement an algorithm that turns out to be patented. And of course, because the United States Patent Office very horribly grants patents on software, which ought to be abolished. But in the meantime, it's possible that someone could patent the software or already have patented the algorithms you're putting into your software. And then you're liable for things like patent infringement. That's pretty scary for developers. Now, it's fortunate that individual free software developers, notwithstanding the codec space, which is a complicated space, generally don't get aggressive attacks from software patent holders, but they could. By joining Conservancy, what happens is the liability protection of Conservancy extends to you when you're acting as an agent of the project. So when you're actually committing code, right now you don't commit in Squeak because you got your whole environment there, but most people think of when you're committing code to the project, you're acting on behalf of that project. Mm-hmm. And the liability protection of Conservancy then extends to you. So if you implement an algorithm that somebody comes along and says is patented and then tries to sue you, you would say, well, I'm working on Squeak. Squeak is a member of the Software Freedom Conservancy. The place you have to sue is Conservancy, and then it's my problem. And that's by design. We want it to be the nonprofit's problem, first of all, because it looks really horrible if you're suing a nonprofit, so we'd use that to make press about it. And second of all, we don't want developers sitting there worried about those things. We want you guys to work as best as you can on the code, and we'll be the lightning rod. If somebody wants to attack the project, they have to attack the nonprofit, and then it's my problem.
Yeah, and I appreciate that especially, too, because, again, being on the Squeak board, I have this interest in making sure that we can act as developers and contribute and cooperate and have a viable project. And I remember one of the things that we were concerned about was we went through a huge relicensing effort to try to get all the code in the Squeak base to a open source license. Some of it had been encumbered at Apple originally when they created the project, and some of it had been encumbered by Disney as it got carried forward. But we went through this great relicensing effort, and we basically had to track down something like 170 people to get them to sign off on the new license. But we came up with something that was acceptable to you guys, saying, here's all the paperwork. We've proven we've done due diligence. So we don't believe at any point here now that somebody's going to come back and say, well, I wrote this little section of code here, and I want to have a portion of whatever Squeak's being used commercially. We won't have that happen because we've done our due diligence to your satisfaction, and then you then provide the umbrella over that so that we can keep moving on and just do the guts of our project and not have to worry about your side of it.
Quite correct. I mean, that was somewhat of a unique problem that Squeak had because of its history. But generally speaking, it's certainly true that with regard to accepting patches and licenses, if a copyright holder, so I talked about the patent situation, but also the situation under copyright, if a copyright holder says, oh, you incorporated my patch and I didn't mean for it to be incorporated, I didn't license it under your license, again, that would be coming to Conservancy and complaining, not to the individual developers. And Conservancy's job is to stand there and be the liability protection in that regard. Of course, that's not just the only thing we do. Obviously, that's how we started. We were just doing liability protection. Then we started doing this thing of collecting donations and reimbursing developers, mostly after we got our 501c3 status. But we've even expanded that further. What we're doing a lot now is we're actually becoming a hub for funding free software projects. So this relates to some of my philosophy about how free software projects ought to be funded. So I think it's great that companies contribute. In fact, we wouldn't have the open source and free software we have today if it wasn't for companies basically out of the goodness of their hearts contributing code into the projects. But I also think there's a healthy space for nonprofit funding of open source and free software. So in some cases, and I have a few examples I can give you in a moment, there have been large chunks of donated funds that have been able to actually fund developers for long periods of time to work on projects. One example is that for the past year, Matt McCall of the Mercurial Project has been working full-time on Mercurial because of donations, both individuals and companies that have donated to Conservancy, and we're paying him as a contractor on a full-time basis to work just on Mercurial so he can focus solely on that instead of having to mix in. He does a lot of Linux kernel contracting. He didn't want to focus on that because he wanted to make Mercurial better, so he switched to just working on Mercurial thanks to funding through Conservancy. In the jQuery project, there's actually two projects being funded. The UI grid project, which is this thing to make basically a spreadsheet grid fully in JavaScript that can work in your browser. And they're working on that, and they're being funded. There's actually three people being funded currently to work on that full time. And jQuery Mobile is being funded in part through Conservancy. So we've been able to collect enough donations for some of these projects that they're really funding developers to write code full time.
That sounds really cool. I mean, so Bradley, a lot of people will know you from your association with the Free Software Foundation. Funny enough that we're talking about nonprofits, it kind of fits in nicely. I know you were formerly executive director of the FSF. I can't say it right. I'll get it right in a minute. I can't seem to say it right. Yeah, of the Free Software Foundation for a while. So I'm curious to know that now that you're back as a kind of a director as well on a volunteer basis, does that kind of, you know, come into your work with Software Freedom Conservancy? How does that kind of split work?
Yeah, this is a classic example of when you wear many hats in the open source and free software world. And notice I'm saying open source and free software. If I wear my FSF hat, I would have to say only free software, of course. Mm. And I'm speaking in my Conservancy role here, and that's why I'm being more broad. So I try very hard to keep the roles separate. There are times when I actually recuse myself from things with regard to Conservancy if it interacts with FSF, for example. If there's a GNU project that's talking to Conservancy, that's a FSF matter. And I've accused myself, and one of the other folks at Conservancy takes over that discussion. So I try to keep the roles very separate. I think the thing that FSF does for Conservancy that's really helpful is it defines a good license list. So one of Conservancy's requirements for joining is that you have a license that's both on FSF's list of free software licenses and on OSI's list of open source licenses. So your license has to appear on both to become a member of Conservancy. So that's an example where FSF sort of laying groundwork that we can use. Conservancy is a very different organization, so I don't feel the roles are in conflict at all. Conservancy is really focused on the sort of hands-on getting funding, getting organizational resources to developers so that they can do their work, and FSF is much more of an advocacy organization. They have a policy issue and a set of issues they're advocating on. So that's how I separate out the two roles when I'm thinking about it, because Conservancy is so much more hands-on, it's much easier to separate out.
Oh, okay, that sounds cool. I mean, so to play devil's advocate a little bit, I didn't tell you this. I was going to ask you this before, Bradley, so we'll see how this goes. But I'm curious to know how it works licensing-wise, because obviously you're very much a free software guy, a GPL advocate, and so on. So if I'm a project and I don't license my stuff under GPL, does that affect my chances of becoming part of Conservancy? Do you have any kind of preferred licenses and things?
Not at all. Our only rule is that rule I just stated. Your license has to appear on both lists. And, of course, FSF lists, this is often confused, FSF lists more than just copyleft. It lists every license that gives the four freedoms out to you, the freedom to copy, share, modify, and redistribute the software. So things like the permissive MIT license is on there, the modified BSD license is on there, the ISC license that OpenBSD uses is on that list. So all of those licenses are fine. And actually, I think we're roughly half and half. I haven't actually done a count, but I think Conservancy memberships are about half copyleft, half non-copyleft. So we're pretty even-handed with that. And it's not obviously all the code that's developed through Conservancy or through Conservancy funding has to be released to the public as free software under an open source and free software license. And that's required by our IRS filing. We promised the IRS we would do that, so we have to do that. But the fact that we're releasing it under permissive licenses, and we know that people make proprietary versions out of that, that's completely acceptable as long as the code that the project is actually developing is released to the public under an open source license. That's all just fine.
Mm. Oh, that's cool. So it's good to hear that there's no kind of pressure to use one license or another. I know it's something that some people may worry about. I was curious to know a little bit about if we can kind of step back a little bit. This is interesting because we know each other pretty well, and I've interviewed you at other occasions, so you may get some of the same questions we're seeing. So I want to talk a little bit about your kind of history in free software, how you became involved in it. So let's take it logically and go right back to the start. So how did you get involved in free software? And how did you become exposed to it?
So it's funny because it relates up to my Conservancy role. So when I first got interested in free software development, it was the mid-1990s. And I actually got involved in the Perl community, which is where I know Randall from initially. I got on the Usenet news groups for Perl and started posting around there. And Randall was basically the hero of the Usenet groups on Perl, answered everybody's questions and all that. But I still don't know to this day how he had all that time to answer all that. Because like you'd log into Usenet and Randall would have answered like 20 questions. Like it was hard to actually answer people's questions because Randall.
I didn't have a life. I gave up the rest of my life with doing that. So that's how. Yeah.
But that was just such an amazing community to be involved with. Randall knows well that the Perl community in those days was really the perfect example of an open source and free software. I mean, the term open source didn't exist then. It was a free software community that Larry created and it expanded to having people like Randall involved. And it was amazing to see. And I got into Perl very early on. Just as a developer, I was interested in the language. And the thing, though, was it was actually kind of hard to get involved in contributing code in those days. It sounds bizarre to people today because you just log on to Gatorius or something and you click fork and you can check out a clone and you can be off in your own branch and then you can contribute patches. It's so easy now. In those days, it was difficult. Larry Wall, for example, just to use the Perl example again, told me once that he sort of had to sit and write Perl 5 himself. There was no way to collaborate. He didn't have anybody nearby him. And if he waited for a Usenet post to go out and come back, it would be 24 hours. So he sort of had to sit there and work on it himself. And it was true in the GNU project as well, which I was also interested in. It was difficult to get involved in development. There was already sort of everybody was working, and it was hard to get into the code base and contribute patches in real time. So I wrote to Stallman at FSF and said, well, the best way to get involved is to ask somebody what they need the most. And I said to RMS, well, what does FSF need the most right now? And he started, the first thing I was the webmaster for the GNU.org website because there was no webmaster. And that's what was needed most. So I consistently throughout my career just sort of looked around and said, well, what's the thing that nobody else is doing that's really important? And I'll just do that, even if it's not what I like the most, even if it's not my exact skill match, I'll just learn how to do it and do it. And so over time, I basically was an invaluable volunteer to the FSF because of my willingness to do that. In the late 90s, I got involved with GPL enforcement because not many people were doing that, and I could talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But Stallman started sending me these GPL enforcement things he wanted me to do and help him out with, and I did. And then slowly but surely, he hired me to be his assistant, which was yet another job no one else wanted to do. And I did that for a while, and then he promoted me directly from being his assistant to being vice president of the organization, which is the fastest promotion and most level jumps I've ever gotten in my life. And then about 3 months after that, I was named basically the first executive director, at least the first person ever to hold that title at FSF. And the rest is somewhat history. I did that for 5 years. I was at another organization called the Software Freedom Law Center for 5 years. And then Conservancy was getting established. I was doing the work as a volunteer while I was an SFLC employee. SFLC helped us get Conservancy started. And after a while, there was so much Conservancy work that eventually there needed to be a full-time executive director, and that happened last October.
Mm. Well, that's very cool. And I don't know if you've told this bit of the story before, but when I've asked you that before, you've often told me about the title of executive director was at FSF was kind of. I don't know. It was mainly given to you because there was a funny story around the problem with the title you had before. Are you okay with talking about that?
Yeah, so this relates to GPL enforcement work. So I started doing the GPL enforcement work, and I would write to these people who were violating the GPL, and I hope we can talk a little bit more about GPL violations in a minute. But when I would write to them and tell them they were failing to comply with the GPL, they wouldn't take me that seriously because my .sig file said assistant to Richard Stallman. And I went to Richard at one point and said, well, hey, you know, these people aren't taking me seriously. Can you just give me another title that sounds a little more official? And he looks at me in a very RMS sort of way and says, okay, well, maybe I should just make you the vice president because that makes the most sense. Okay, you're vice president now. So that's how I ended up with that fast promotion. Richard just decided, oh, yeah, that sounds like the most sensible thing to do. An executive director is something that I later asked for because that's sort of the more common title for the person who's in the day-to-day charge of a nonprofit organization. So I suggested that to Richard, I guess, about 3 to 6 months later after the situation I just described.
Mm, okay, cool. And you mentioned that you were you kind of consider yourself a developer, but you are doing the work that kind of the boring work, if you like, the developers don't want to do. So, do you still get time to program and to develop on things as well?
Not really at all, unfortunately. Sometimes on the weekends I get some time. It's something that it's probably the biggest lament of my life that I haven't spent as much time writing code as I wish I would have. I have a master's degree in computer science. I've written various patches for Perl, for BusyBox, for a lot of different free software programs. But I've never been a core developer very much on one. I did spend some time. Actually, that's not true. I did spend some time as a core developer on a program called PokerSource, which is a online poker system written completely in Python and released as free software. So I did do some development on that, but that was just sort of a game, so it doesn't feel like it's real programming, I guess. Lately, I've been playing around with GNU Bash because I have some features I want to add to Bash that really have annoyed me for years. But it's only little patches here and there, unfortunately, that I get to do. And I sort of see it as my job because I think everybody who enjoys programming, which I do a great deal, would rather be programming. No matter what you're doing, most of the time, you'd rather be programming. And that's somewhat true of me, but I also see this need for there to be a nonprofit hub for free software projects to get services for nonprofit issues. And so it's so important that I'm willing to sort of give up what I'd rather be doing to continue doing this work.
It was a bit of a leading question in a way, because I've heard you mention that you were working on Bash at the moment, and everybody needs Bash, don't they? I thought I'd get that in there. That's really cool.
I'm working for Bash is I don't think anybody else needs it. I have my entire Bash history going back to 2003, and the problem Bash takes forever to start up now. So I'm working on a patch to basically read the history more incrementally, not all at once when it starts up. I'm probably the only person in the world who's crazy enough to keep his Bash history all the way back to 2003.
That is a that is an impressive history. I'm just thinking to myself, would I ever need to sit there and think, what was that command I typed back in 2004 around Christmas time? I suppose. Well, that's the whole beauty of free software and open source. If there's a need, and you can, you know, scratch your own itch, as they say. So that's very cool. I had a little question to do with the kind of similarity or the difference between Software Freedom Conservancy and a body that some people listening may also know, which is SPI, or Software in the Public Interest. I was very fortunate to have a sit down and a chat with Bidel Garbi, who runs that at FOSDEM, and I was curious to know, because they're doing something, as far I don't know much about what they do, it's something similar. So what are the differences and similarities between what you do?
So SPI is very similar in that it's also a fiscal sponsor organization. I should also mention the Apache Software Foundation is very similar in this regard because it has an aggregation of many projects. Mostly, there are different tweaks on the same model. So one of the things that's true about a Software in the Public Interest, SPI, is they tend to have a much more hands-off kind of approach to fiscal sponsorship. So they don't have as many services. So they have a smaller service plan. They're mostly there just to collect donations and to process those donations and pay them out for the project's goals. They don't do the liability protection. They don't do GPL enforcement, which is one of the services the Conservancy does. They don't do pretty much the other things that are on our service plan. But it also means that it's a much more informal relationship. So you, to join Conservancy, you have to sign this formal paperwork, and everybody has to agree and all that sort of thing. And they have to deal with me a lot and to communicate a lot. SPI, you pretty much only have to talk to them when you want them to pay out any money. And that's better fit for a lot of projects, and that's completely reasonable. If that's the better fit for your project, I've even referred projects to SPI, because if all they really want is to accept donations and be able to pay them out, SPI is a much better fit if that's the only thing off of our service plan that they want. Other than that, I think SPI and Conservancy are very comparable and similar. They just have a smaller service plan. With regard to Apache Software Foundation, they're very different because they have a much more, in some sense, they're more formal than Conservancy, because you do have to relicense under their license, under the Apache Software license. You have to go through their incubator process to join. And they don't accept directed donations for their member projects. So if you make a donation to the Apache Software Foundation, it goes into Apache's general fund, and then projects apply to receive grants out of that general fund. By contrast, Conservancy, you can donate to, say, jQuery. So if you go to jQuery's website and you click donate, that donation is going to be earmarked for jQuery, and the jQuery team decides who receives the funds from that. And of course, this is a downside to Conservancy somewhat, because our general fund is much smaller than our project fund. So I do encourage people to go and donate to support my salary and support the work that we're doing in the general thing by going to sfconservancy.org/donate. But most of our donations are actually directed at our projects, not to our general fund. And so that's a real difference between us and Apache in that regard. The only thing I want to add to this point a little bit is that I think it's really important that we have lots of different options for these types of organizations. A lot of people have encouraged projects to stop starting their own nonprofits because it's very difficult to keep a nonprofit going long term. But there are a number of fiscal sponsorship options out there. We've just talked about three of them, and there are a few others too. And people should look into those options and consider them before starting their own organization. And each of these organizations has a tweak on it. And frankly, everybody's going to get full over time. I have 30 applications pending at Conservancy now for projects. I hope to accept between 10 and 15 of them this year before the end of the year. But once we get to that point, we're going to have to start thinking about, can we grow any further, and how do we fund staffers if we do grow further. So I think having lots of options means that people can apply multiple places. I actually often encourage projects to apply to Conservancy and SPI and Apache all at the same time and just say, apply to all of them, see which one you like the best once you're accepted and which ones you're accepted not. Sort of like going to college, you know, you just apply to a bunch and see how it works out and then decide which one you want. So I think that's a real value to have multiple organizations like this.
Since you brought up the funding a moment ago, I'm curious as to how you get paid, and is there, like, when somebody donates directly, say, to Squeak or to jQuery, can you talk about, like, is there a portion of that that gets set aside for the Conservancy itself, or is it all passed directly through?
It's funny you said a buzzword that the IRS hates called pass-through. None of our donations are pass-through. Because pass-through, to the IRS, pass-through means there's no oversight. And, of course, I'm overseeing all the donations to all the member projects and making sure they're being spent in the right way and so forth. So none of them are they're pass-through. I know the sense you mean it, and it probably is in the sense you mean it, but not in the sense IRS means pass-through.
I'm sorry for saying oversight. The wrong keyword then. Explain how it actually works, and then just go from there.
The IRS is the IRS, right? They love to have buzzwords and things and weird acronyms and all that. That's one of those cases. But yeah, as far as earmarked is the better phrase. So if somebody gives to an individual project, it's earmarked for that project, and we design Conservancy that the developers, the leadership team of that project, are the ones who decide how it's spent. Now, it is true that fortunately some of those leaders have decided to donate some percentage back to Conservancy's fund, and generally that's between 5% and 10% if they're donating back at all. And we have some that are giving 0%, quite a few actually that are giving 0% back, and we don't begrudge them that, especially if they're a small project. I mean, a great example is a project that gets, say, $500 a year in donations. Whether or not I get 25 or 50 bucks into the general fund from that, it's not going to make a difference in make or break for Conservancy. I'd rather see such a small amount of money, all of that go to help the project. And also, they're not making much work for Conservancy by having $500 a year being managed. I mean, at best, they can pay for their servers, and that's about it. So from that point of view, I encourage projects that aren't really big on getting, don't have a lot of donations coming in, to just keep it all. Don't bother to give back. But ones that are bigger, I do ask them to give back, and they do, when asked, give back some percentage of their donation. We also accept donations from everybody, from the general public, from corporations, to Conservancy's general fund itself. A number of companies do give. Some of them like to be said that they give, and some don't, so I tend just not to say any of them specific by name. So we get some money that way, and then people donate to general fund. We don't get as many donations to the general fund as we do to individual projects, but if people like what I'm talking about and are glad that I'm out here doing this, I hope they will consider donating to the general fund. But at this point, we have enough funding to fund one person. I'm a very conservative fiscal nonprofit manager, so I always make sure there's a year of funding in the bank before I start. Before I started working in Conservancy, I made sure there was a year ahead to pay my salary, and at all times I make sure there's a year budget in the bank, because you never know what's going to happen in the nonprofit space. So we're stable, but I'd like to grow. We'd like to have more staffers if we could. I tend to work 12 hours a day, and it would help to have more people, but I'm not going to hire until we have the funding, so I hope people will donate. So that's I suppose that's enough of please donate pitches. I apologize if I went on too long with that.
That was a pretty good pitch there. I'm also then curious, so if you're collecting the funds for the 20 groups, how can people get money to you? Do you have various? I mean, do you take credit cards? Do you take cash in an envelope? How does that work?
Yeah, cash in an envelope, it's hard to track, so I prefer not to receive that. We do take checks in an envelope. You can put a check in the mail, and you just put in the memo line what project you're earmarking it from. That works fine. Every project, we give them a specialized PayPal button and a specialized Google checkout button, which they can use. And of course, you can use PayPal and Google checkout to pay with credit card. I've looked into credit card processing. It's actually somewhat more expensive than doing the credit cards through PayPal or Google checkout. And in fact, actually, Google checkout's kind of cool, because they, if you're a 501c3, you get no fees from Google checkout. So it's basically a donation that Google checkout's making to nonprofits. So if people give on their credit card, to any Conservancy project through Google checkout, there's no fees at all, which is really nice. And that basically means more of your money goes to work. So if people do want to give by credit card, I encourage them to use the Google checkout option, that they think Visa and MasterCard, to do it that way, because that way we get more of the money. Because I think a lot of people don't realize that there are huge, usually between 5% and 8% fees that are taken from every credit card transaction, when you use your credit card. So Google checkout's the best option with regard to credit card payments, and you can put a check in the envelope too. That works as well. We take wire transfers. If anybody wants to make a wire transfer, they just email me, tell me what project they want to go to, and we'll hook them up with the wire transfer information.
And also, how does it work internationally? I know that you have the nonprofit stated in the U.S. Is there any equivalent for that internationally, and are you able to do that, or is this just going to help the U.S. people?
So I've been researching that question for many years. It is a complicated issue, and it's really tough. So currently, anybody in the world can donate to Conservancy. There's no restrictions on who can donate. But the tax benefit for donors, i.e. being able to write it off on your taxes after you donate, that only exists in the U.S. So I've looked at how to do this in other countries and how places like Amnesty International and other organizations that exist. And what they do is they form a nonprofit in every jurisdiction. So we're working. I work with one of our board members, Loïc Vacherey, who's in France. He and I are looking into how to set up a conservancy in France. We initially thought that if you set it up anywhere in the EU, you could have tax deductible nations throughout the EU. As it turned out, our lawyer unfortunately told us, our EU lawyer told us that wasn't true. So it's actually really hard to do that. So long term, I want to do it for conservancy. We have a lot of developers and donors and member projects in Europe. I'd like to be able to take tax deductible donations in Europe. And hopefully we'll get there, but it's a really tough problem. In the meantime, people can donate to the U.S. organizations in Europe, and then the only downside is that they don't get the tax deduction from it.
And corporations don't get any kind of tax deduction. I mean, they get the sort of just general having funded somebody deduction, and it wouldn't make any difference whether it's a 501c3 or not, right?
It basically doesn't matter. Technically speaking, I think, I'm not absolutely sure, but I think that companies can do that. They never do because it's tax deductible as a business expense for them anyway.
Right.
So, because when you're a company, you can just pay your business expenses, and that does you don't pay taxes on it. You pay tax on your net, not your gross. So they just net it out when they make a donation. So they never really actually look into taking advantage of it to being a charity. Companies tend to like it though, because it looks much better. If you say, "Look at this charitable giving our company has done," that looks a lot better than we paid for some advertising. So many times when companies donate to nonprofit related to free software projects. It's primarily an advertising thing, or you know, they're trying to say, "Hey, look, we support these guys and get their name out there in that community because they sell services around that code base." But it looks a lot better if it's characterized as a charitable contribution to the public rather than advertising, right? Being able to stand up at a conference and said, "We gave a charitable contribution to the FUBAR project," that sounds a lot better than "We paid to advertise here so that we could say our name." So I think companies do like it that we're a nonprofit, and I've had companies say, "Hey, this is great. You know, we want to be able to say we made a charitable donation."
I think also being a nonprofit in the U.S. would mean that if someone has a corporate policy that they'll match funds or something to donations of nonprofits, you'd certainly be available on the list, whereas, say, Walmart wouldn't necessarily be someplace that they could pay with a matching donation.
Right. In fact, we do. I get these things in the mail all the time from this place called Easy Match, which is a sort of aggregator of that. And lots of companies do have us on their list. And if people are donating to any member project of Conservancy, I hope they will make sure to ask at their companies. And I think this is generally true if you're giving to nonprofits. You should always ask at your company and say, "Do you have a matching program? And here's the nonprofit I'm giving to. I want it on the list." From my side, as an administrator of a nonprofit, I just fill out a form and send them a copy of our 501c3 paperwork, and then we're on the list. But you can't get on those lists if an employee doesn't ask. So yeah. I hope everybody out there listening who's an employee and wants to give to any nonprofit, not just Conservancy, but anyone out there that's in the free software and open source world, they should ask their employer to get it on the list and see if there's a matching program.
And before I skip over this, what's the SFLC and how does that relate to the SFC?
So the SFLC is a different organization. I used to actually work there. I worked there for 5 years. It's an organization that provides legal services to open source and free software projects. And one of the things that happened when I was at SFLC was we discovered that projects didn't just need legal advice. They also needed this organizational infrastructure. They needed the liability protection, all these other things we've been talking about. And so we launched Conservancy as a separate organization to do that. And then for a while, I was funded by SFLC to work some on Conservancy. After a while, there wasn't room in the schedule and the budget to do that. So I was just doing it as a volunteer. And then it just grew large enough that it needed a full-time person. So I left SFLC to be a Conservancy. So that's how it sort of came to be. And we had a relationship through me, basically, because I was an employee at SFLC when Conservancy was started. But now we've always been a fully independent, separate organization by design. But now I'm actually an employee of Conservancy working full-time just on Conservancy's issues.
And can you or do you want to talk about the recent personnel change at SFLC?
I have no. I'm actually very glad that Karen Sandler is working for the GNOME Foundation, because I think she'll be an excellent executive director, and she's a personal friend of mine. I have no information now of how that impacts SFLC, because I haven't worked there since September 2010. So I just don't know what's the internals of SFLC anymore.
Okay, just wanted to bring that up there. Let's see.
I think it's great that Karen's the executive director of GNOME, because GNOME Foundation, because she'll do excellently in that job. And I have a blog post up on my website if people want to read more about my opinion on that specific thing.
And I also just want to say that earlier when you were saying you were getting geeky IRS wise, you could have pointed out that 1023 is 2^10 - 1.
That's a good point. I have actually thought that before. I didn't think it in that moment, but I have thought that before. I remember when I first learned what a 1023 was, I was like, why didn't they make a 1024? It would have been such a nicer number.
And so, just quickly, while we're talking about the situation with the GNOME Foundation and so on, Karen Sandler, who we just talked about, was working for SFLC, is now to become the new executive director. And I just wanted to mention something that I happen to know about the process, which is you're on the advisory board, Bradley, and you actually very responsibly, resigned as soon as you found out that Karen, not resigned, that's not the right word, you know what I mean? Once Karen's name was in the frame, you kind of backed away because you didn't want to be accused of conflict of interest. Is that right?
Yeah, I've been a volunteer in the GNOME community and on the advisory board for some time, and as part of that role, I was asked to serve on the hiring committee specifically, and that's the thing I did resign from, the hiring committee for the executive director. When Karen's name sort of became the forefront of the list, I actually resigned from the hiring committee because I know Karen so well. I was like, I sort of told her what I thought. I was like, I'm completely biased. I think Karen's wonderful, but I should resign from this committee because I know Karen too well, and I really can't be on a hiring committee. The last thing I wanted was to be in the middle of her salary negotiations being her personal friend. So I was like, I'm out of here. I got to resign, but I hope you hire Karen, and I'm biased. And then left it at that. But yeah, so I think it's great. I think it's great for GNOME Foundation, and it's true in a lot of nonprofits too. People move around. I mean, I was at FSF for many years, for example, and moved on. People like to do new things, and staying in the nonprofit space is really what's important. And that's why I'm very glad to have worked in the nonprofit area since 1998. I don't know where I'll always be. I'm planning to stay at Conservancy for at least 5 to 10 years. We can keep it going. But long term, I'm always going to be in the nonprofit space no matter what I'm doing, because I just really believe that nonprofit activity is important in the free software world. We need lots of commercial activity, which there is, and lots of your guests talk about the sort of the commercial models of open source. But from my point of view, there should be a healthy not-for-profit aspect to open source and free software.
And something that I know is very important to you that we've talked about a lot between ourselves is the GPL enforcement stuff that you've done. And you mentioned it briefly before and said that you wanted to talk a bit more about that. So can you tell us a little bit about what you've been involved in, and have there been any successes and so on?
Oh, I was so waiting for you to ask that. So I've been involved with GPL enforcement, as I mentioned earlier, since my early days at FSF. And I believe strongly. I know Randall's views on copyleft, and he can give me a hard time about it if he wants. I'm happy to debate it. But if you believe that copyleft has any validity at all, like it's a valuable thing in the world, which I do, I know Randall maybe doesn't, and that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. We can disagree. But if you believe copyleft has some value, it needs to be complied with. People need to follow it. The whole idea of copyleft is you use the copyright system to make sure the software stays open source and free software. And I've always believed that, and because I'm a fan of copyleft. So for the Conservancy member projects that are copylefted, which is not all of them, it's probably more like half, Conservancy does offer GPL enforcement services to the project, mainly because I'm involved with Conservancy and I have so much experience doing GPL enforcement is really what makes that possible. So BusyBox is the project that takes the most advantage of that, although some others do as well. And we've done a very large amount of BusyBox copyright enforcement, GPL enforcement through Conservancy. So we're currently in litigation against a number of GPL violators, and people can go and read on. There's a thing called PACER, which has all the proceedings of public court cases. My lawyers always tell me never comment on ongoing litigation, so I won't comment in detail on that litigation. But that's one example of sort of the worst case of GPL enforcement, that we do file lawsuits. But most GPL enforcement is actually really a friendly conversation. between us and the folks who violated. I see it as an education opportunity to explain to them what the requirements are. The reason there are so many violations, specifically on BusyBox, is a lot of embedded systems companies don't even realize that they've got GPL software, Linux, and BusyBox, and all this other stuff in their firmwares. And so I treat it as an education process to explain to them, look, you've got this stuff. The requirements aren't onerous. All you got to do is get the source code to the users and make sure they can compile and install it. It's not that hard. And that's the education thing that I go through in GPL enforcement. And I think it's really important because I think the whole idea of copyleft is to make sure that when somebody goes to some big box store and buys a wireless router or buys any product at all that has GPL software in it, the GPL assures you that you are allowed to modify it and install modified versions, and we want to make sure people are able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. So, I mean, the whole thing I mentioned there before about have there been any successes, and you mentioned BusyBox and so on. That case, is that case still ongoing? There were a lot of different electronics manufacturers, you know.
Yep, there were
mentioned in that.
We filed litigation against 14. I think I can. I was on the public proceeding, so there are two left, and we settled with them. And that's usually what happens in GPL enforcement cases. We come to an agreement whereby they're going to comply with the license. When people learn what we really want beyond any other thing we're asking for is just to comply with the license and do what the GPL says. If they're able to, they do it. And once we can help them get into compliance. They do. The reason it sometimes takes a very long time is you sometimes have like three levels of upstreams. So what happens is somebody actually ships the product in the U.S. They bought it from some party who's probably in Taiwan, who sometimes bought the software from a third party, fourth party really, who had gave them the firmware, which they then put into the device, which they then sold to the company in the U.S., which then distributes in the U.S. The most common answer I get when I inform the last company in the chain, hey, you're violating the GPL, it's a software license. They say, well, I don't have any software in my product, it's a hardware product. I say, well, there's some software in there, it's a firmware. And we have to chase it back through those chains of distribution. And that's what takes time, is getting the communication path, which sometimes has a language barrier involved, because you're talking to folks in Taiwan many, many times, and you slowly but surely have to convince them, look, you have to get the source code package together, it has to build, it has to install, and that process is really what takes all the time. But the willingness to do it is usually there, and we usually get compliance. So there's tons of successes all the time in enforcement. One of the things we don't do is sort of admonish people publicly for having violated the GPL. A lot of GPL enforcement work is done privately, mainly because we don't want to badmouth companies if they just made a mistake and they want to learn what the rules are and get into compliance and do the right thing. So we tend to do most GPL enforcement without going out in public and saying, hey, these guys are violating and we're going to go after them. The only time it usually becomes public is when we file a lawsuit, which is usually in pretty much, I'd say, between 5% or less of the cases where we actually have to file a lawsuit. It's probably much less than 5%, probably closer to 1%.
Hmm. Right, yeah. It's something that I know is you've often said to me is very important to you, is not to kind of bash people over the head and make them look bad in public without first contacting them and helping them to come into compliance. I know that's a big thing for you. It's a kind of, you know, it's not about attacking them. It's about trying to helping them understand that they're making a mistake and this is why and how they can fix it. But something else I wanted to ask you about, which I know you were involved with, is the Affero GPL and its effect on web services and so on. So can you tell us a little bit about that? Because these days, web services are kind of taking over the world, it seems, and we're all running proprietary web services, albeit maybe on a free software desktop. So how does that affect things?
I should note that there are no conservancy projects that are under the Affero GPL. So it's really off topic from conservancy to answer the question, but I'll answer it anyway because this is one of these cases where, through my involvement of FSF, I was involved in a different thing that's unrelated to conservancy. I did invent the idea of the Affero clause back in 2002. And the problem that came up was this guy named Henry Poole, who's now on the board of directors of the Free Software Foundation with me and many other people, he originally came to the FSF and said, hey, I want to start a project, and I want to make sure it's free software, and I would use the GPL normally, but it's going to be a web services project. So when I release the code and somebody else puts it up on a web service, the GPL sort of functions the same way as like the Apache license in that case. There's nothing wrong with the Apache license. I'm surprised Randall hasn't come into me about copyleft. I was hoping to debate Randall about copyleft.
It's coming up.
It's coming up. Okay. But the point is that with regard to web services, the GPL and the Apache license are basically the same, because the GPL is centered around the concept of distribution. So if you put a web service up, you don't actually distribute that code to your users in the usual case, which means if it's GPL or Apache license, your requirements are the same. That's by design. The GPL was designed to be that way, to always trigger on distribution. Well, there was this idea with the Afero clause to say, well, if the program has a feature to give its source code out, make it so that you can't remove that feature in future versions. And that was the idea, to make a copyleft for web services. So it's a stronger copyleft than even GPL. So if you don't like GPL, you probably really hate the Afero GPL, because it takes copyleft one step further. And because of that nature of taking copyleft even a step further, the FSF, I think, wisely, although I disagree with it, wisely decided to leave it out of the actual GPL. So it didn't put the Afero clause into the GPL itself. It's a fully separate license. So if you like that extra copyleft, you can choose the Afero GPL and you can get the web services copyleft. But if you just prefer the usual thing that we've been used to for all these years about how GPL works, you can just choose the regular GPL. So that was a decision that Spallman made, because he felt like it wasn't right to add this clause, because it would have surprised people. So we made it a separate license.
You know, I'm going to shortcut your entire debate about the GPL. I believe that the GPL is appropriate for many situations. I have an opinion that there are some commercial situations that would not be able to take advantage of GPL code. And if you want your code used everywhere, you pick a non-copyleft solution. That's all. It's a choice by the author.
Yeah.
I don't have any problem with people choosing the GPL or choosing more BSD-style licenses. I just want people to be aware of the fact that if they choose the GPL, there's a lot of places I've worked that wouldn't be able to take their code.
Oh, yeah. So we're much more – all these years, we should have had this conversation, right? Because I thought we were less in agreement than we are. I'm actually in full agreement with you. I believe that if your goal is to get your code used as many places as possible, a permissive license is a much better choice.
Exactly. And that's all I've ever argued.
It has no barriers. And there are cases where that's really important. For example, it's really good that let's take Aug Theora, for example. It's really good that's under a permissive license, because the codec issue is so bad that there are so many patent-encumbered codecs that you want a patent-unencumbered codec to be available to as many people in as many ways, and it doesn't even matter if the code's proprietary or free. You want that codec out there. So there are a number of examples like that where permissive licensing is a better choice, because the goal is to get the code adopted as quickly and as widely as possible, and that's more important than copyleft. I always say copyleft isn't a moral principle, it's a strategy.
Yes.
The moral principle is giving people the freedom to copy, share, modify, and distribute. I believe that's a moral issue. But how you get that done, that's a question of strategy, and different strategies work better in different contexts.
And since I've got somebody who thinks a lot about this, where would you put the EPL? Would that be kind of in between permissive and restrictive, or what?
So the EPL is in between, and like the LGPL. So when you go from the spectrum to, you sort of start with the AGPL is basically the strictest copyleft. We just talked about that. And then you go all the way to the other end of the spectrum. You have things like the ISC license, which OpenBSD uses. There's actually this license called the Do What the F You Want license. It actually says the word in the license. But that's like the full spectrum, right? And you could sort of land anywhere on that spectrum and say, well, this is where I want. I would say like the LGPL is sort of right in the middle of that spectrum. The Apache license is sort of halfway between LGPL and ISC license, right? So it's in the middle there, because it's a permissive license that has a patent clause and so forth. So this is sort of like this linear spectrum that you can look at. The EPL is sort of, people debate this, like where it falls in that spectrum. My view is it falls close to the LGPL, but closer to GPL. On the GPL side. So it's sort of like maybe three quarters in the way towards LGPL. The EPL is more of a copyleft than Mozilla Public License, for example, which is very liberal. It's more liberal than even the LGPL. So the EPL is a little bit more conservative. Now, this is a hotly debated topic of how strong the copyleft is in the Eclipse public license. So my view will not be shared by everybody. Richard Fontana is probably freaking out on Identica saying, no, he said it wrong. The EPL is not like that. But it's a question of interpretation, how strict of a copyleft it is.
Very good. I'm really glad we brought this up, though, because talking to an expert here is I've had a lot of requests over the years where people say, can you just kind of explain all these licenses? And it's like, well, hey, now we've got the expert. Thanks for coming on the show and explaining that for us. But before we let you go, we're running low on time here, but before I let you go, I hear you have some sort of podcast?
Yep. So Karen Sandler, whom we mentioned before, who's just become the executive director of the GNOME Foundation, she and I host an audio cast. It's available in MP3 too. We call it an Ogcast because we like the Og format, but it's available in Og and MP3. That's on Faith.us, FAIF.us, which stands for Free as in Freedom. And we talk about mostly policy issues. So if your listeners are interested in these issues of what licenses are and how they work and how projects set up nonprofits and what their policy questions they face are, and we just covered this issue of LibreOffice and OpenOffice and the politics behind it. So we're sort of like I think of us as political pundits of open source and free software. That's sort of what we do. And also Dan Lynch, who's here with us on Floss Weekly, he is our producer on that show. And now occasional co-host, but not very often. But he's our producer, gets it all sort of up there for us and the audio together. So I hope people will think about listening to that if they enjoy podcasting. If they're listening to this one, they might want to try that one out too.
Well, that's why Dan poked me in Skype.
To mention it, yeah.
I thought there was just an innocent question there, Dan, but I guess you're right.
No.
Okay. Well, Bradley, it's been really great having you on the show. Is there any last thing you want to tell us before we have to let you go?
Sure. I think if folks want to read more about me personally, I have a blog on my website. My website is ebb.org/bcoon. And you can find me there. And I don't use Twitter because it's proprietary software, because, as we've established, I'm kind of a free software zealot. But yep. I am on the thing called Identica, and you've had Evan of StatusNet on before who's talked about Identica. So if you want to follow me there, I'm at bcoon on Identica.
Very good, very good. Well, it's just been a pleasure having you on the show and explaining a lot of these issues I've been sort of curious about for a while, and good seeing you again, or good hearing from you again. We bump into each other occasionally at conferences and things, so I'm glad to be chatting with you today. So thanks for coming on the show.
And thank you, Randall, for everything you've done in free software. I'm probably aware more than most people of how long you've been involved and how much you've given of yourself. I think all the way back to those YouthNet days I was talking about, and I really appreciate how much you've given to free software. And Dan, you are the man of podcasting and free software, so I appreciate all you've done, too. So, and thanks so much
thank
for
you.
Having me on.
I'm not going to compare myself to Randall in any way, but he's done far more than I have. But let's start before people start getting upset and nauseated
by
us all.
Ages. I won't say how big that delta is, but there is a delta that's non-trivial. I won't embarrass Randall by saying how big it is.
I still have my natural color hair, though. Anyway.
He does, yeah. You
anyway,
have
just, hair. Now I'm humbled. It's like I can't continue after that, but thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And that was Bradley Kuhn, who's the director of the Software Freedom Conservancy. Really great conversation. What do you think, Dan?
Yeah, obviously really interesting stuff. And it's a strange situation because obviously I'm a good friend of Bradley's and we kind of work together a lot. So I tried to make it not too, too much of a softball conversation. But I didn't realize your relationship through the Squeak, the Squeak project and so on. Mm-hmm. That was really cool.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, having been on a number of nonprofit boards, I know how difficult it is to get all going. And when we were looking at what we were going to do with the Squeak organization, because we were no longer we were getting big enough that we were sort of could have been a target, I thought, well, let's get some wrapping around this. Actually, that started happening before I was elected to the board. So I was just sort of helping to make it all come through. But I remember doing a lot of work to make sure that went forward. Yeah, so I know Bradley from historical things and current things. So it's all working out. In fact, I just got email from like yesterday about the SFLC personnel changes, why I asked about it. So yay. So speaking of guests, my awkward transition for the day. Unless you have something else you want to talk about, Bradley, before we wrap up.
No, fire away.
Okay, very good. Yes, we have a huge list of people for Q3. I have been working my fingers off getting all these mails sent out so I can get them all slotted in. Next week, I won't be here. I'll be in Brazil about 2 days after the Floss Weekly taping. I'll actually be giving a talk called Lessons Learned from Flossing Weekly, and I'm abstracting all the interesting things we've come across in the 170 shows we've had so far, and also talking a bit about the production, like what happens behind the scenes. I'm actually going to refer to Linux Outlaws show number 200 because you had a great behind the scenes description there, so I'm going to talk a little bit about that in my talk, so that'll be fun. We have Aaron Newcomb's going to sit in the host seat. Actually, we don't know who the co-host is. I guess he hasn't asked you yet, but Dan may be the co-host. We don't know who the co-host is for next week, but it might or it will be Dan again. But we got Travis Tidwell talking about MediaFront.org, and I've lost my notes on it. Do you know what MediaFront is?
I don't know. I wasn't expecting you to ask me. I could quickly Google it if you like.
You can Google any of these, I think, is the way to find out about that. Neil Gump is coming out in a couple weeks after that. Nano CMS, Content Management System. Paul Beckingham and Federico Hernandez are going to talk about Task Warrior, which is a to-do manager. We're going to try to do a live show from OSCON on July 27th. Simon Phipps has agreed to co-host that. We're going to try to put together the same thing we did last year, which is we'll be like live from the floor, and we'll try to get some interesting project. People tend to make announcements there, so we're going to try to get one of the people that's making an announcement there. So it'll be a timely show. Again, don't know who the guest will be until we get there. Colin Percival is going to talk to us about FreeBSD on EC2 Cloud and also about TarSnap, which is a great backup solution and the open source software he uses for that. Perry McDowell will join us to talk about Delta 3D, which is a reality engine. So it's got all the visuals and all the mechanics and lets you do some really, really fancy stuff. It came out of the military, actually, because they had to write all these big simulations for doing war games and stuff. Chris Shunneman. What I need to do when I write these people is say, how do you pronounce your name? And I need to get back the pronunciation of everybody's name. Sorry about that. If I'm mangling your name and you're an upcoming guest, I apologize in advance. He's going to talk to us about Synergy, which is a program that lets you take one set of mice and keyboard, one set of mouse, one mouse, one keyboard, and run multiple machines. You just kind of drag your mouse the way you want to go, and it pops over onto the other machine. Cross-platform, too. Pretty amazing stuff. Brian Call, Leif Hedstrom are going to talk to us about the Apache Traffic Server, formerly developed at Yahoo, now part of the Apache Project. Really high-performance proxy server with all sorts of really cool stuff going in between that. Adam Armstrong is going to talk to us about Observium, which is a network management tool, be able to check all the things that are happening on your network. Tomas Muros, LibCloud, the whole virtualization stuff, making sure that you can run your stuff in the clouds easily. Chris Moore, PCBSD, that's the version of FreeBSD that has a sort of a user-friendly installer and installs a lot of things you need for a desktop version of FreeBSD. Jonathan Ellis, just added to the list, I believe. Cassandra, the NoSQL solution that is part of being used by some very large organizations. Jeffrey Thalhammer rounds out Q3 with Perl Critic, which is kind of a lint for Perl. Lets you you get to observe all the things that are kind of wrong with your code, at least the things that can be detected at compile time by staring at the code, a little bit better than Perl warnings do directly. And so we've got all those people, a lot of more people on the list as well. If you go to twitch.tv/floss, you can see the link from there of the people we're trying to schedule in there. If you know someone, if you know a project or a personality like we have had in the past, and they aren't on the list, have the project leader or the person email me. I will add them to the list and start offering them slots once we open up our Q4 slots. I'm probably going to start booking Q4 in about a month, so there won't be any new additions to the active list for then, but that's just how the show works. Let's see. So as I said a moment ago, I am going to be at FISLE, which is the big open source convention, about 5,000, 6,000 attendees, next week, and I'll be giving this talk on things learned from that I've done from the Flossing Show. I'm also going to be at OSCON in July, as I said there. I'm actually teaching a three-hour Perl class there. There's still room available, I understand. So if you want to know everything there is learning Perl in 3 hours, come to the class. It'll be a lot of fun. And also be hanging out there looking for more Floss Weekly guests and just to hang out and have fun and have at the party. And you can follow me on Twitter. I am at Twitter at Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N. Oh, speaking of Twitter and Identica, and Posterous is that, we have set up a few weeks ago, I think we mentioned this once already, but we set up a few weeks ago a separate Twitter and Identica feed for Floss Weekly. So you can subscribe directly to Floss Weekly. You don't have to subscribe to my Twitter handle, and I've actually lost about 70 people because of this, but you don't have to subscribe to me because if you don't want to hear about my Foursquare check-ins or what I had for lunch or see my stupid things I'm doing with Toon Paint or whatever, that's fine. You don't have to listen to any of that stuff. Some people find it amusing, but that's okay. It's, I know 70 people apparently didn't because they subscribed directly to Floss Weekly. That's fine with me. And it's also set up in such a way that even when I have one of my other hosts take care of the show, when they post to the Posterous blog, it posts automatically to both the Identica and Twitter. So whenever we have an announcement we're making about Floss Weekly, that's where you're going to hear about it first. So lots of stuff there. I think I've got through my list. Dan, what do you want to plug today?
Yeah, I was just going to say quickly about the Posterous, I think it is, that I posted to it yesterday, and it works great. So, you know, when you were saying about other hosts doing it. But, yeah, the main thing I want to mention, you've been talking a bit about events. So you're off to Brazil, and obviously OzCon's coming up. I've mentioned this before, but we're running an event in the UK. It's going to be the biggest open source and Linux event in the UK. It's called OGG Camp. And that's OGG Camp. And it's going to be in August, on 13th and 14th of August. It's in Farnham, which is in Surrey, down nearer to London than I am, anyway. And it's free to get in, and you just need to sign up via Eventbrite so we have an idea of how many people are coming, and we don't end up with 5,000 people and 200 sandwiches and a lot of angry people and, you know, things like that. Go and find out more at oggcamp.org. That's oggcamp.org, and you can find a link there to how to sign up and find a bit about who's going to be talking and what's going on. And if you've got an idea for a talk or a project or anything that you're involved in, you want to get some ideas on, maybe run a session on it. We have a bar camp, you know, it's a bar camp kind of thing as well, so you can come along and talk about what you're up to and maybe get some information from there. We've actually had some projects started and some actual open source projects that have started from people who've met at previous OGG camps, which I'm really, really proud of, that they kind of got talking over beer or whatever and said, hey, we should start a project to do this. And now there is some software out there that wouldn't have existed otherwise. So go and check that out. And that's enough of a plug for that, I think. And then if you want to find out anything about what I've been up to, like recently I went to the Red Hat Summit in Dublin and met the CEO, Jim Whitehurst, interviewed him, so you can find out more about that on Linux Outlaws and hear the interview and so on. You can head to danlynch.org, and you'll find my Twitter and Identica and everything on there.
Very good, very good. Again, and I also want to recommend highly, I listen to Linux Outlaws every week, and you guys do a great job putting the show together you and Fab, putting the show together to get some great interviews and also just really timely news. This show, Floss Weekly, I don't want to turn into a news show. It's more of a magazine show, so we're just doing a single interview every time, and I want these to have like nice back catalogs so people can go back and listen to various topics that are timeless. You guys do all the timely news, and thank God for taking that off of my hands so I don't have to do it.
Well, no problem, and I appreciate your support. It's always great.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I'm hearing a little music come up, so that must mean it's about time for the end of the show, so we'll see you all again next time on Floss Weekly.